This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Azo. Ever felt off balance down there? Introducing Azo Vaginal Health Products. Azo Complete Feminine Balance helps restore the balance of good bacteria. And if you want protection from yeast and urinary tract issues, try Azo Dual Protection. Save 20% with the promo code PODCAST at azoproducts.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And we are live. Hello to Emily Barth Eisler.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And thank you for being here. And that's actually a good segue to remind myself that I have to say what the program is. So my name is Mel Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And I have a wonderful guest. I would say this evening here in Israel, this morning where you are in Burbank, Los Angeles, California, the epicenter of the movies, and you're a movie girl.
I'm a fan.
So much to talk about. So Emily Barth Eisler, welcome. We are gathered here, you and I, to celebrate your brand new book. Do you have it to wave around and show everybody?
Of course I do. Thank you so much. Yes, this is The Color of Sound. It's been out just a little over a week, and I have to do this when I show it because the full cover is so beautiful, front and back. Gorgeous book design, and it's been really exciting to finally share it with people.
So before you tell us about the fictional characters, let's give kudos to the other people who are behind you. And one of them is another Emily.
Yes.
My debut picture book is about a girl named Emily, and here you are, and you're Emily, and your agent
meant to
is
be.
Emily.
My agent is Emily Keyes of Keyes Agency, and it's provided lots of laughs and some confusion, and we're just now trying to find an editor named Emily for one of my future projects so that we can really complete the Emily connection. But no, it's a wildly popular name for our generation in
it's
America.
It's funny because when I was looking for the name for my picture book, maybe because I live in Israel, I was looking for a special name that isn't that popular. I said, oh, Emily. But
my parents say the same thing about naming me in 1980, that, there weren't a lot of Emilys. It was unique and different and, historical. Emily Dickinson, it wasn't unheard of, but it was like fairly uncommon. And then all of a sudden, I got to third, fourth, fifth grade and everyone was named Emily. So, whatever, we try.
Everyone's an Emily.
Everyone's an Emily.
Whether
that's
you have
okay,
a Willie
though.
Or a Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. So we mentioned Emily Keyes, your agent, and who else was involved?
My editor for The Color of Sound is named Amy Fitzgerald, and she is just, one of my favorite humans on earth, an incredible, incredible editor. And this book would definitely not be what it is without her. This is my second book with her. So it was really fun to sort of come at it from a different angle. When she bought Aftermath, it was, I'd say finished. Obviously she gave some beautiful edits and shaped it and we worked on it together, but it was a completed manuscript as opposed to when I sold The Color of Sound, I sold it to her based on a proposal and a couple of chapters. So it was much more of a concept. And we got to sort of enjoy it together as it unfolded, which was a new experience for me and really rewarding. And I say this in the acknowledgments of the book, but I'm grateful to Amy when I wrote to her that the original proposal for the book involved many of the elements that ended up in the book. But as I went, I decided it was really much more about generational trauma than I was expecting. So when I sent her an email saying, how do you feel about generational trauma? Luckily, Amy wrote back and was like, I love it. Let's do it. So, you know, it takes a special editor to be willing to kind of go to some of the darker places that I like to write about and to, you know, sort of help me make sure that I'm telling the story authentically and but also relatably. And I can't say enough good things about Amy. She's
and,
great.
And the publisher is an imprint of Lerner.
Exactly. Lerner Books. And the imprint is Carol Rhoda. You know, you can see all that good information there. And Lerner also published my first book, Aftermath, and they've been absolutely wonderful to me. And
it's a dream. We'll talk about Aftermath, and then we'll talk about your whole career, Emily, because I'm always intrigued. So tell us about The Color of Sound.
The Color of Sound is about a 12-year-old violin prodigy named Rosie, who has synesthesia, which is a neurological phenomenon where people can see music or hear colors, or another popular example is people can taste words, or it's when any two senses or three senses get intermingled. So there's a version of it called mirror touch synesthesia, which I've been learning about, where people feel touch that they see happening to other people. There are over 80 varieties of synesthesia. So there's no one definitive experience, but so Rosie is a violinist with synesthesia, but she's basically keeping the synesthesia secret. Her parents put a lot of pressure on her, particularly her mom, to be this violin prodigy. She has, you know, she's played Carnegie Hall twice. She's all over the place with orchestras full of adults and kids and everything in between, and winning contests and things like that. Violin is her whole life. And so when we start out on the book, she has just made the decision that she's on strike. She's not playing the violin right now, indefinitely, maybe ever. And her mother is very upset about this, of course, because they've devoted so much.
She's going nuts.
Yes, the mother is going nuts. And because Rosie is on strike and she's not going to this summer camp she usually goes to for musical prodigies, she has to go with her mother, who's going to Connecticut to visit her parents, Rosie's grandparents, where Rosie's grandmother, Florence, has had Alzheimer's for many years and is in the end stages of Alzheimer's, is dying. And Rosie doesn't know her grandparents very well because there's obviously some tension between her grandparents and her mother that she doesn't really understand. And so she goes along on this trip, and while she's there, she's exploring in their property and finds a shed that she feels drawn to go into. And inside is a girl who it appears to be is her mother when her mother was 12, which is Rosie's age. And through that relationship, which is kind of an unexplained quirk in time, there's a little magical element to the book. Through that relationship, Rosie begins to understand her mother and herself and her grandmother and her family's history and why the violin is important to her mother and why music matters and why a lot of other spoilers I don't want to give up. And she also develops a really beautiful relationship with her grandfather, which is really special, and makes some friends at the library, and has just a very different summer than what she could have expected.
And ends up going back to music.
Yes.
Boy, did I spoil things?
No, I think it's clear. She ends up going back to music is actually the perfect way to say it, because
on her terms.
On her terms, in a different way. Yeah, I mean, music is part of her. I think as soon as the reader begins reading about her, you see that while she may be on a break from the violin, Rosie's brain, it can never be free of music, nor would she want it to be. It's constantly, I gave her very purposefully a different kind of synesthesia than the kinds that I have. I have multiple kinds, but not the kind Rosie has, because I didn't want this to be about me or my subjective experience. But one thing we have in common is that there's always a song playing in my head. At any given time, there's music playing. It's sort of like a radio station, and I can turn it down, but...
Is there a song playing right now?
Oh, yeah.
What's playing?
Sarah Bareilles, The King of Anything. It's just what's playing. Might be different later. There is always a song playing in my head. And I've learned to turn it down. Sometimes I don't even notice it. But
can you sing a bit of it? You're a musician.
Yes, but I'm not going to sing right now. I'm not warmed up. That's something that Rosie and I have in common. So music is never not part of her life.
Okay. So towards the end, I'm going to ask you to sing a little bit, even though you're not warmed up.
All right. We'll see how this goes. We'll see.
All right. Because you know where I'm coming from. Sometimes you just have to go outside your comfort zone.
Yes, that's true.
And we will, after this is over, you and I will say goodbye to everybody and come back and have just a tete-a-tete, and I'll explain to you how important it is to sing sometimes even when you're not warmed up.
All right. I love it. Okay. I'm intrigued. Okay.
But we're not going to tell everybody else our secrets. So I must say that I found this book intriguing, and I'm not a person who usually reads middle grade, and the people who follow the video cast and the podcast should know that 98% of the authors that I interview are picture book authors.
And I'm excited about that because I have two picture books coming out later.
I know. But for the meantime, you're middle grade.
In the meantime,
so I was really intrigued to read this, but I'm no maven. So the questions I'm going to ask you are going to be stupid questions.
So there are no stupid questions. Well, those are the best questions. I think sometimes the most basic questions are the ones that get to the heart of it.
So when she goes to the shed and meets her mom, and you've done this like it actually happened. Mm-hmm. My reader response is, well, that's a kind of a I wouldn't say synesthesia, but it's a kind of a mirror response that anybody who's lost something, you know, lost a parent. Now, you know, we're in the middle of a war here. I speak to my parents every day, and they've been gone for years. So when this is just my response, when reading it is, well, it's fiction. It could also be in her head.
I like that take. I purposefully wanted it to be open to interpretation. For all books, but I think particularly for middle grade, where your readers for the most part are kids who are really making their own judgments and decisions about the world for the first time, or they're early on in that process of differentiating from their parents and their teachers and what everybody else has told them. I like a little bit of ambiguity in the books to allow the reader to make some decisions about what they think it is, what they think it means, what they think is happening. And so I appreciate that, you know, I like your interpretation. I've heard a different thing from, you know, every reader I've talked to so far who's read the book. Everybody has a slightly different take on what it means or how it actually happened or where it exists or and I think that's part of the beauty of a book is, you know, it's a one-on-one experience between reader and author, even when the author is not physically present in that experience, but it's a dialogue.
So I'm going to, even though I'm not a maven, I'm still going to highly recommend this book for parents and children, because I think as a parent, now I'm a grandparent, there's always this dilemma when you have terrifically gifted children, and maybe all children are terrifically gifted, and you put them into this straitjacket of pursuing one particular trait and ignoring all the other parts of growing up as a child. So now, let's talk about Emily and your trials and tribulations growing up as a super talented prodigy.
Yeah, well, thank you. I don't know about prodigy, but you know, it depends how you define it. But yes, I definitely had an unusual childhood in which I had talents and abilities that thrust me into a different life than most of my peers were experiencing. I started acting and singing professionally when I was 5 years old. So I would
tell us about that.
You know, I don't remember the beginning because I was so little. So for me, life always kind of involved performing. I don't remember never not doing it. My sister and I started out together as a duo. We were in plays together. We're 4 years apart, but you know, we had like the same hairstyle with the two braids, and we did shows together, and it was, you know, we were kind of a team. And I mean, it was a wonderful, idyllic experience in most ways. I really enjoyed it. I loved being part of a team like that with grownups and other kids sometimes, but mostly with grownups. I was one of those kids who was happy to hang out with the adults. I would go to school during the day and kind of be one person. And then at night, you know, I did dinner theater, regional theater, local commercials type things in the Baltimore, Washington area where I grew up. And, you know, so at night I would usually be doing a show, do 8 shows a week. Sometimes, thanks to child labor laws, I would have an alternate. So I'd do 4 shows a week. But there were times over summers or whatever where I would do all 8 shows a week for a run of a show for 3 to 6 months. And I learned so much about being an artist, being a creative person, and being a storyteller. And I really think a lot of those skills are still present in my life today as an author, because at the base level, it's all about telling stories and how do you share a story with an audience, whether you're singing and dancing and using somebody else's words or whether you're using your own words and telling a new story. You know, there are elements that there are threads I can see. It's not like I had this completely unrelated experience as a child. And I also played several musical instruments. I played the viola and the harp. I was classically trained as an opera singer. I spent a lot of time in music and with music. And, you know, in that way, relate to Rosie. I was not the kind of musical prodigy she is, but you know, there's only so many hours in the day. So, you know, there is a world, I think, where I could have focused more on music like she did. And I am grateful to my parents who, unlike Rosie's parents, my parents made sure I still had a very well-rounded, complete life. And so I had a bat mitzvah and I had a, you know.
Yeah, but so where's the angst?
Oh, there's lots of angst.
Emily, I need the angst. I need the angst.
Oh my God. Well, the angst lives inside me. I am an anxious person. I've always had generalized anxiety disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. Plenty of angst, both clinical and circumstantial. Yeah, I mean, I had like a really busy, high pressure childhood.
We have so much in common.
Okay, tell me about yours.
I'm a reformed agoraphobic.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Talk about anxiety.
We're not moments.
Gonna, have thousands of people want to hear about writing and stuff. So we won't get them anxious.
Okay.
Where was the angst that led to your story here?
Particularly to The Color of Sound.
Or general as a writer. There has to be
as angst, a writer.
Emily.
Well, I think a lot of what made me want to be a writer is it was just something I always wanted to do. But I think a lot of the connection to wanting to be a writer was through my grandfather, my father's father, Alan Barth, who and my given middle name is also Alan. So I'm Emily Alan Barth, and he was Alan Barth. My grandfather was an editorial writer for the Washington Post and a reporter, but primarily an editorial writer for 30 some years until he died right before I was born. So I never got to meet him. But as an editorial writer, he had the opportunity and used his privilege to talk about many things that were going on in the world in the 50s, 60s, 70s, McCarthyism, things like that. But his real focus was always First Amendment rights. And then in the 60s, gun control. He was a very passionate advocate for handgun control, which is what they called it in the 60s. This was directly following the assassinations of Martin Luther King, JFK, RFK, he decided to use his platform of the written word and the Washington Post to write over 1,000 editorials about gun control, 77 of them consecutive days. And as a result from that action, he inspired President Lyndon B. Johnson to sign the first comprehensive handgun legislation of that time. Now, of course, we now continue to have gun problems in America, and they are different, and they are in some ways bigger. We now have assault weapons, machine guns available to citizens, which is a whole other story and part of the inspiration for me writing Aftermath, my first book. But we're talking about The Color of Sound. But my grandfather, I think, inspired me in two ways. One is the idea of inherent loss. You know, I was born already missing him. I often felt like I wasn't entitled to grieve him because I hadn't known him. And yet on the other hand, I had never known him. So the grief was in some ways more immense. And that also plays into Aftermath, which is largely about grief and sort of the comparing of grief that we all do. And what are we entitled to grieve and how are we allowed to feel and that kind of situation. But I grew up accustomed to, like, I was already acquainted with loss. I had friends who had not yet lost anyone in their family. You know, they had all their grandparents, they had their parents, and, you know, and I was lucky I had parents and aunts and uncles, but I had lost both my grandfather and one of my uncles before I was born. So there was never a time where I wasn't aware that mortality existed and that loss was possible and that people could be young and otherwise healthy. So I think I was always looking for connection to my grandfather, but also meaning. And I found so much meaning in his written work that he left behind, not only in the power that he had to use that writing to make social change, but also the way that it left behind a legacy that I could read as somebody who loved him without having met him. I was able to understand what mattered to him through his work that he left behind. And so I think in that way, I saw writing as this almost magical time travel. I mean, that's how that comes to The Color of Sound, is like writing was this incredible power that people had to connect across generations, across time, posthumously, all sorts of things. And in that way, I think it was also lucky my grandfather showed this example of making a living as a writer, which a lot of other writers growing up don't have that that advantage to see that. And so that's why I love doing school visits to show kids that being a writer is a job.
Emily, before we move on here, we have to solve this. A 5-year-old needs agents. A 5-year-old needs parents that channel and funnel.
Right. No 5-year-old wakes up and says, I'm going to go audition for a play.
Sweeten your business purchases with American Express Blue Business Cash, the card that makes everyday expenses extra rewarding. You'll earn 2% cash back on your first $50,000 in purchases per year, and then 1% after that, so you can treat your bottom line and give your business a helpful boost. Swipe after swipe. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/bluebusinesscash. Amex Blue Business Cash. Built for business by American Express.
After countless steps and more than a few miles, your dog drives you forward one last time to make that final climb. And as the rising sun peeks out from the horizon, you know, incredible happens here, because it starts here with the fuel that makes it all possible. Pro Plan Sport. Discover advanced nutrition made to fuel strength and stamina in active dogs like yours at ProPlanSport.com.
Yes, and I know you want to be very kind to your parents. I hope they're well.
They are. They're great.
And maybe they're watching. And hello.
It's totally possible.
You've created this wonderful, wonderful person, and congratulations. And but what did this do to you? I mean, you know, being funneled.
You couldn't
all have been good.
No, certainly. I think, but I see it now only in terms of the good, in that I think it gave me a lot of empathy for you know, it required me to sort of live a double life, or as we say in America, I don't know if this is a phrase that's popular in Israel, but code switching, usually used in America for people of less represented cultures and races, have to code switch when they're in largely white spaces of, you know, the way that you express or sort of hide some of your cultural context when you're in largely white spaces. Now, obviously, I don't have exactly that experience in exactly that way, but I think what I learned was how to exist in spaces that were populated by my peers, as well as in spaces that were populated by adults. And in that way, I developed empathy for my peers who were code switching in other ways. I understood inherently what it was like to have kind of two different lives and to be a different person in each of those spaces. And I think that's kind of the crux of middle grade too, is stories about people figuring out who they are still within the context of living in their household of origin most of the time. And how do you code switch of like who you want to be versus who your family expects you to be?
So what happened to you? What happened to Emily? Emily Barth, you weren't married, right?
Not for a little while.
When you were 11.
Right.
Those things don't happen anymore. Well, rarely. And you're growing up, and now you're writing, and usually I ask authors, but with you, I kind of guess that you're writing to your 11-year-old Emily.
Yeah, in a way, but also to my kids. I mean, part of the idea for The Color of Sound was I'm in this unique and beautiful spot in life where I am the sandwich generation. I have my parents still alive and well, and I have kids who are at this moment, 9 and almost 13. And I am a daughter and I'm a mother and I'm a person individually in the middle. And I can't help but think that had a lot to do with the idea of wanting to write a book about these generations and how we all affect each other. And it was sort of born out of this idea too, of talking to my kids about some of the struggles they were having.
Emily, okay. But you see, what you're saying is I'm a mother and I'm a daughter. And mm-hmm. and okay, and you could have written an adult story because you write for adults. We'll go there in a minute, right? About what it's like to be an adult and a mother and a daughter and a granddaughter.
Sure.
The moment that you give me a middle grade to read, okay, maybe it's just me. I say, okay, I am now opening a window mm-hmm. to Emily conversing with her 11-year-old Emily, the same way that in your book you have Rosie conversing with the with the young Shoshana, and I think it's beautiful.
Thank you.
And you can say I'm wrong, but it doesn't matter because I already decided.
No, I think you're right, and I think middle school was such a formative time for me. Those years, between like 10 and 14. There's, again, I don't know what it's like in Israel, but in America, there's sort of the reputation that those years are just terrible and like bother. You know,
I grew up in Ottawa.
Okay, so you understand. And I don't agree, obviously, because I write for middle grade. I think those years are the most magical. They were the most magical for me, too, of my school years, pre-college and adult life. If I had to pick the best chapter, middle school was it for me. I felt on top of the world. And part of that is I had a really extraordinary teacher during middle school. He was the gifted and talented resource teacher, and he saw in me this actor kid and encouraged me to be a writer as well.
One second. It's really important to shout out to teachers.
Yes.
And to give them credit. What is his name?
His name is Terry Sullivan. I talked about him in the author's note of Aftermath, and another teacher I had in high school named Eric Ebersol, who was my math teacher for a couple of years, my calculus teacher.
These are the people who change lives.
Yes, absolutely. I feel really lucky to have had two teachers like that who gave me gifts in the form of perspective and context and, you know, academic content that stayed with me 30 years later, to the point where now I'm still talking about it. That's an incredible gift.
Listen, I'm 72 and I still talk about my high school teachers.
It is really amazing. It's really amazing.
These are the most amazing people that they change you forever.
And we need to pay them better and treat them better, but that's another podcast episode.
Absolutely. And that's not the own voices. Let's go back to Emily. Okay. So, but you were meant, as somebody in your family had decided when you were five, that you were meant to be a thespian, an actress with skills in music. And somehow this morphed into another Emily, just like Rosie, maybe.
I like that. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way.
So was middle school the time when you said, okay, you know, you guys have funneled me to be a an artist, and that not an artist, excuse me. I like the word thespian. I like to use that.
Right.
But essentially, that's not me, guys.
I don't think I had that realization till a little bit later. And then I backtracked a little bit. I think I was, I did take a summer off from performing, I think when I was 10 or 11. And I really missed it. And I remember going to see the play that I would have been in if I had, you know, auditioned that summer for this summer theater production, and thinking, yeah, I miss it. I wish I were up there. But I don't think that was a hugely formative experience. I think, I went to a very intense high school, or a high school with an intense performing arts department. And there was a lot of pressure there for everybody to, you know, who was going to make it, who was going to do it, beyond school. And in one way, I had already done it outside of school. I'd already done it professionally, but I found myself wanting to prove that I could do it as an adult, which, as it turns out, is like not a good reason to go into a career, to just prove you can do it. It became very clear to me as an adult when I moved to New York after college and pursued acting and had some success. I was on a soap opera fairly regularly, a small part, but a recurring part. And did some theater, did some commercially type stuff. And I didn't love it anymore. And I don't know if I ever had loved it in the way that I thought I did at the time. I found, particularly as an adult, when it became about making money and trying to get health insurance and not as much about being part of a team and making music with other people, it lost a lot of luster for me. And then the other thing was that, you know, as I got into more professional adult roles and was getting these tiny parts where I had a line here or a line there, I didn't feel like I was storytelling. You know, I think the actors who have the bigger roles, like, of course, that, you know, they're bringing so much to it. But, you know, I played a diner waitress on a soap opera and it was tremendous fun, but I didn't feel like I was contributing to the story. And I ended up getting a job with a web, like a branded entertainment internet company, where I was writing, producing, and performing. And that was the first time it was very clear to me that I enjoyed the writing so much more than any of the other stuff, that was where my heart was, that was where I could tell the stories the best way. And that, and I remember, you know, getting auditions as an actor in my early 20s, where they give you part of a script called Sides for an audition. They sent me part of a script for an independent film, you know, and it was just a scene. And I just remember being like, okay, what happens next? I want to know the story and like my idea of what happened next. And I realized I wasn't as interested in that version of whatever the writer was going to write. I was like, I kind of want to sit down and write my own version of what happens next. So it became clear over the course of a couple of years that I was not enjoying performing as an adult. It's very different. It's one thing to do it as a child. And I was really, for me, it was never about money. It was never about fame. It was never about success. It was just pure fun. And then you get to be an adult and it's like the whole game changes as to what your goals are supposed to be.
It's
and
wonderful.
I didn't love it.
It's wonderful that you were able to morph into this new Emily.
I feel so grateful.
Not everybody can. Some people.
Well, and I think what I really struggled, I knew that I didn't want to act anymore, but I felt like there was inherently some quote unquote failure in changing. And it took me a really long time. And I credit my husband, who is just one of the smartest, most like emotionally intelligent people I know. We met in college. And so we were together through all of that. We moved to New York together when I was still acting. And he was one of the first people who was like, this is not the thing that's making you happy. Like, this isn't it. Like, you need to be a writer. That's where you shine. And not in a way that put any pressure on me, but just in a way that like, he sees me, he gets it before I got it. Mm-hmm. But I felt like by saying I'm not enjoying acting anymore, that there was inherently some giving up. This thing that I had done my whole life, like I said at the beginning, I don't remember a time when I wasn't acting. So for me to be able to say, I don't want to do that anymore, was a huge loss of self. And I had also had, I mean, I'm not going to go into detail, but just to touch on this, we talked about two teachers I had who were wonderful influences on me. I also had a teacher in high school who was really hard on me and who put a lot of pressure on me and was a bully and was unkind and was constantly challenging me to say, I don't think you've got it. You can't do it. You can't do this. And so I think that gave me a sense that I had to prove her wrong, even though I was long done with performing. I didn't want to do it anymore, but I didn't want her to think that she had won, you know, not a good reason to go into a career, not a good reason. You know, I would wake up, I had friends who were actors who every audition, they just relished the chance to perform. They would go see every play and every tiny theater in the West Village just to be there. And I didn't have that passion for it. I never did. And it became clear to me that like, this was not my dream. Not the same way that, you know, when I had free time, I would go to the library and get every book, every young adult, middle grade book.
But Emily, look how important this is, you know? Somebody sees a talent in us when we're 4 or 5 years old and channels us into becoming a gymnast, an actor,
a soccer player, a
musician.
Right, yes. Any of those things, yes.
Whatever. And that can be really, I wouldn't say devastating, but just because you're very talented at something doesn't mean that that's you. I mean, I was a talented scientist for 30 years, but it's not me. I'm much right. more of a picture book writer now. I mean, I feel like I've come out of the closet in a professional manner. You know, I say.
I know exactly what you mean, and I think
really a scientist
for a long time, particularly American culture, was not really into change and you know the metamorphosis of becoming something else. You know, it was very much like your identity is your job, and you stick with it, and you know, like. My dad had this, my dad's also a writer. He was a TV reporter until he retired and wrote his own stories and, you know, investigative journalism and features and stuff. And he had the same job for 35 years. Yeah, and I think that was the model that the world used to be based on, that like you did something and you were great at it. My dad was great at it. And then you stuck with it. And so the idea for me of changing careers felt very scary.
And yet
I think it's so much more common now. But also it's just, yeah, I grew up with the mirror of society saying to me, yes, you're an actress. Yep, you're an actress. You're an actress. Largely positively until I got to high school and had this really devastating bully of a teacher who really wanted to see me fail. I think because I'd had success so early. I think, you know, some people see success and want to take it down, want to take it apart. And I spent a lot of time trying to prove that she didn't succeed. And that didn't make me happy. And so when I finally said, like, who am I doing this for? What is this about? And I realized, what do I really want? There's also a lot of power in choice. I'm actually thrilled that I didn't find writing earlier and have it be part of my childhood. I mean, I was a writer as a child, and I entered in contests and I wrote plays and things and like had some success, and I had enough validation to be like, oh yeah, I'm good at this. It's fine. But I'm really grateful I got to choose it as an adult, and it's wholly mine. And I got to, you know, I never got to choose theater or acting. I remember watching friends in middle school and high school fall in love with it, discover musicals and get obsessed and like fall into that world. And I don't remember ever not being part of that world. So I didn't feel like I got to choose it. And so writing is something I got to choose. I got to fall in love with it. I got to discover it. I got to make it mine. And there's a tremendous power in that too. I think choosing a career and a path as an adult is really exciting. And it's something everybody should get the opportunity to do.
So this is a good opportunity to segue into your writing career. So you have several hats in your writing career. You also write about brands. You've written on the Oprah Winfrey website. And what's particularly interesting to me is all your articles in Allure magazine. Because I also wrote for Allure as a scientist 30 years ago.
No way. Oh, yeah. You said we had a lot in common, and I didn't know that's where it was going. That's amazing.
And here alongside your career writing about cosmetics, and that's maybe we'll talk about that another time.
Sure.
You are like one in, we talk about this all the time, one in several thousand writers who make the tremendous effort and have success and find an agent and find traditional publication. And in addition to these two wonderful middle grade with Lerner, you have one picture book I know coming out in 2 years. I want to have you back on the show.
For sure.
With Nancy Paulson.
Yeah.
Always Enough Love. So yeah, I mean,
it's a dream.
If I haven't bored you today, I want to have you back then.
Oh no, I want to come back. And I have another picture book, which hasn't been announced yet, but I'll let you know with a different publisher.
But I'm gonna give you a harder time in 2 years because picture books, you know. Okay. So how did you succeed? Did your writing stories for brands help you succeed writing stories for children?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think about that a lot. I started writing about sustainable and eco-friendly beauty products purely for fun on the side with a friend. We started a blog because we thought it was interesting. Basically, we were always emailing each other about like, oh, I tried this new lip gloss. I think you'd like it. And it was her idea to like, let's put this out there. It was, 2009 maybe. And blogging was new. And we were like, okay, this sounds fun. And what did we know? Neither of us had kids yet. We had lots of time. We were like, let's write a blog. And that took off. And I found a lot of exciting purpose in writing, not just about beauty products, but specifically around the sustainability angle, planet health, personal health, waste reduction, that kind of stuff, as the beauty industry was like really starting to explode into the world it is now. And I think what that taught me was the power of finding a niche and specificity and becoming really good at one thing. So I, for a time, was one of the experts in this very particular area of beauty. And now there's a million people doing it, but there was a time when less people were talking about it. And I was one of a handful of people who really knew where the ingredients came from and how to talk about sourcing and, ethical production. Are we paying people fairly? Where is the packaging coming from? Where are we sourcing the products? Who picks the rose petals that become the distilled rose water that becomes the scent of this product? I wrote for Allure, I wrote for Oprah, all of these like really exciting benchmarks. And I thought that would help me get an agent. I had the original dream was writing YA and middle grade and picture books. And I thought one would help the other. And I don't know that it directly did, but it gave me two things. One was it taught me how to really hone my craft and get specific and figure out what I was good at and how to do it and, put in my 10,000 hours to become an expert. But also it gave me something to do while I was waiting for the other thing to happen. I think it really stinks to be focused on one goal and have that be your only iron in the fire, because we all know that getting traditionally published is a long and winding road that is full of rejection and hard times and lows. And I credit my friend Hannah Nyer, who it's her birthday today.
Happy birthday, Hannah.
She's watching. Hi, Hannah. Was the person. She's also a kid lit author, pre-published. I remember was reading when I was blogging, she was reading my stuff and she's a former attorney. So she was looking at it from that angle and she's like, why are you giving away all of your knowledge for free. You have got to like, you got to start selling articles to magazines. It was, she was the one who's directing. And I remember saying to her, no, I really want to be a children's book author. I want to focus on that. And she's like, why can't you do both? Like, do this while you're waiting for the other one to happen. And that was so helpful because there were days where like, I mean, so much rejection. I queried 200 agents at various times. I faced so much rejection. And once I've had a couple different agents, because sometimes it's hard to find the right fit for the right book. You know, sometimes you have to change tactics. So, you know, I've been through the ringer of rejection with agents, with querying, with publishers, with so many close calls for so many books that are in drawers. And during that time, it was really helpful to also be publishing articles in Allure and Oprah and Pop Sugar and all these other things. Like, I tell people it's kind of a blessing that writing books is generally not enough of a living for most people. Most authors need to have another job. It's kind of a blessing because that's where you get validation or other ideas. Like that's why when I talk to kids about being a writer, I like to say, you know, no, you don't get good ideas from sitting at a desk in front of a computer 8 hours a day. That's not a life. You get your best ideas from going out and living your life and observing and interacting with other people and yes, having a full and complete well-rounded life. That's where your ideas come from. And I just wrote a piece last week for Oprah about swimming and my relationship to swimming and writing. And I wrote most of The Color of Sound while I was swimming laps. That's where my brain is sort of freed up to think. And I would put my phone on the side of my local community swimming pool, swim laps and take breaks in between sets of laps and, you know, either voice dictate or write down just like pieces of dialogue or plot points that I had. And then I ended up making swimming a big part of the book. As you've read it, it becomes like kind of a major plot point because it was sort of a very meta experience. It was an important part for me for writing it. And so I wove it into the story. But that's an example of how that magic doesn't happen because I was sitting at my desk. That magic happens because I was out there having a life. And so I'd say in that way, beauty writing is also helpful. It's taken me places. It's gotten me, you know, I've gone on trips to write about things and meet people.
This episode is brought to you by Rockstar Energy Drink. Be honest, are you procrastinating by listening to this podcast? It's okay. You just need Rockstar Focus. Choose from three delicious flavors, each crafted with ingredients for an ideal energy and mental boost, like Lion's Mane, 200 milligrams of caffeine, and zero sugar. Visit rockstarenergy.com to learn more. At least 75 milligrams of caffeine has been shown to help improve attention.
When Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like Sweet Tarts Twisted Rainbow Ropes, Gummies Fruity Splits, and Chewy Fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine. Visit SweetTartsCandy.com to shop now.
I must say that, you know, every author that I've interviewed, and more than 150, it's a very rare occasion. You're competing with thousands of other manuscripts. Some of them are written by people who've already published. You know, some are agented. Some have met the editors, and you have to be better than them because you have to break in. And interestingly, when I try and look at these stories, I find a disproportionate number of authors who had different kinds of writing going on at the same time, in marketing, anything that had to do with writing, that could morph into their ability to tell a story.
Yes. Yeah.
And you talked so much about stories.
Yeah. So tell us, it's all stories.
Okay, so tell us the story. So Aftermath was your debut book, and you also won an award, the Mathical Award. That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
It's amazing. It's really helped so many people find the book.
Give us a little episode of the 10 minutes that changed your life. That how did this happen?
Of writing Aftermath or
no,
winning the award?
No, of having somebody say, I want this book, or I want this author.
Yes. You know, it's so funny. I think when people tell the story, it often sounds like it's one moment, or people distill it into one pivotal moment. But I see it as just like a slow 2-year-long collision course towards finally getting a yes. With Aftermath, we had so many close calls. It was out on sub for about a year and a half. First on an exclusive with somebody for a long time, and then widely to a bunch of people. We got so many close call rejections where people would say, you know, I really love this book, but the first really big close call was a big publisher said, we want to buy this book. We love it. It's a beautiful story of grief. Just like one tiny change we want to make, just this one little thing. Instead of it being set against the backdrop of a school shooting that happened years ago that all these kids are recovering from, we want to turn that into either a tornado or a bus accident. We don't want to talk about school shootings. And my agent brought it to me, and luckily she was aware enough of my feelings to say, I know you're not going to want this. And I said, oh, no, absolutely not. I felt really strongly that piece of activism about gun control, about talking about this absolute horror that goes on in America all the time of
and your link and your link with your Zadie.
Yeah, exactly. Like there was no way I was going to compromise on this topic. But I also like to present the fact that it requires a tremendous amount of privilege to say no to something like that. It requires financial privilege. My husband has a career where I don't have to worry about putting food on the table for our kids with my writing. That's a crazy amount of privilege. And we have to talk about that in publishing because it doesn't pay enough for people to feed their families.
This is also something that it doesn't necessarily come up in the discussion because I don't ask the authors, most of whom are women, mm-hmm. You know, how they live in nice houses. You mentioned it, but it's not something I'm going to ask, you know.
Right. No, but if I had been a single person trying to make a living off of that point, I would have had to compromise a lot sooner. There were a lot of moments where I had the privilege to stick to my guns. And I think disproportionately, particularly in America, people, you know, white people with lots of privilege are more able to stick it out in publishing. And we're trying to change that with organizations like We Need Diverse Books and other initiatives to try and level the playing field. But like historically, it's been a lot of people who come from privilege because they have the privilege to stick it out until they get successful. Anyway, that's kind of a side note. So
it's not a side note. It's really important.
It's the note. Yes. I definitely feel a responsibility with a particular amount of privilege to make sure I am lifting up and sharing the spotlight all the time with people who are behind me in the process or have less inherent privilege or whatever. And so there were a number of close calls like that with Aftermath where people did not want to talk about gun violence, which was just a non-negotiable for me. It was really important to me. Or where a publisher wanted to buy it. And then they were like, but, you know, are you firsthand a survivor of gun violence? And I'm not, thank goodness. They really wanted it to be an own voices story, which is not what I bring to it. And I found that really frustrating because I see myself as an activist and a journalist. I see this problem going on in America, which is mass shootings. I see that kids who are in middle school now have been raised with these active shooter drills from the time they're in preschool and kindergarten. They want to talk about it. Their parents of my generation think that it's not on their mind because it wasn't part of our growing up. And I really wanted to connect those dots. I wanted to give kids and parents a conversation starter to talk about this issue. Now, the book is really largely not about the school shooting. It's in the background. It's a conversation starter. But it was really important to me to bring it up. And several publishers said, we only want to publish this if you, Emily Barth Eisler, are a survivor of a school shooting. And I thought, that is horrifically unfair to the kids who did survive school shootings to say, the only way we can have this conversation and tell this story is if you want to grow up, go through all of the rejection that we've just talked about, the honing of craft, the time it takes. the immeasurable amounts of therapy I had to go through writing about such a difficult topic that isn't even my personal experience. I think that's a lot to ask of survivors of school shootings, to say the only way your story gets told is if you're able to tell it yourself. I don't think that's how empathy works. Now, I see the own voices movement is very important. I personally should not be writing a story from the point of view of a young boy of color who grew up in, you know, I don't know, Alaska, whatever, like someplace I didn't come from, right? I should not be writing those stories. But when it comes to fostering empathy through experiences and something, I always tell people, I'm not a direct survivor of gun violence, but I live in America, which means I am affected by the trauma we all go through every day. And don't wait until you're personally affected by it. Get affected today, because it's happening and no one is safe from it until we all get together and we need better legislation. We need different leadership. We need a lot of change. You have to allow yourself to be affected. Like, thank God, no, I'm not directly affected. And I don't want to take away from the trauma that direct survivors have lived through. But I am able, through empathy and research and journalism, to get the right. And I worked on Aftermath with a number of gun violence survivors and organizations, and I donated a large portion of profits to several gun violence organizations. I was very clear, this isn't my story to tell. It's not about me. It's a conversation I saw a need, and I saw I'm the person to do this. It's an activism. But it was really interesting to butt up against that in publishing. And along the way, so many people said to me, why can't you just write a simpler book, like a less controversial book? I had to do it. I couldn't stop. There were other books I had written that I put in drawers, but this one I was like, I have to tell this story.
So this, yes, so this is a story where you're channeling also your Zadie's, your grandfather's focus.
Well, and it comes back to what we were just saying about privilege, when you have a platform like he did, he was employed by the Washington Post, and he said, I'm going to use this platform to talk about something that's not comfortable, that's not safe, that's not what people necessarily want to hear, but I'm going to use this platform to solve a problem.
So after the success of Aftermath, you've written a story which is perhaps much more you.
Yeah. More personal, sure.
I had to get rid of that. And how's the feeling now that the book is just out?
Ooh. I mean, it is a roller coaster of feelings, mostly good. I'm so proud of the book. I'm so proud of how it turned out.
I feel
like, oh, thank you. I think it's, you know, special and unique and different, and I'm really proud of it. There's also something very scary about writing something personal and putting out in the world, and some people don't get it. That's terrifying.
We have to wind down, even though I told you I would go on speaking to you for hours. So at what age did you know that you had synesthesia?
Oh, not until my 30s. I had no idea.
So this is the thing about human beings, you know, we're all different.
Yes.
We grew up thinking that everybody's like us.
And that is exactly why I wanted to write this book about synesthesia, because synesthesia is real. It is a thing, but it also works as a gorgeous metaphor for the way we each experience the world in a unique way. And until you say to somebody else, oh, you know how the color red is the perfect middle C? And they say, no, that's not part of my experience. Do you realize that not everybody sees the world? And again, like, it's a metaphor. It's also for the way that our own biases, our experiences, our...
Emily, this happened to me 4 months ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. I was interviewing Dr. Jen Malia about her book and talking about stickiness. And I said, Jen, you're writing about certain kinds of autism, but really everybody.
It's a spectrum. That's why it's a spectrum.
Sticky things. And she says, oh no, it's not true.
Right. Not everybody.
I say, oy vey. You know, I'm 72 years old. So for 71 and a half years, I thought that everybody ate sticky. So first of all, that puts me on some kind of spectrum. Totally. Secondly, you can go through a whole
umbrella of
and be dead for 20 years.
Yeah.
And not realize that you were different than everybody else.
It is crazy when you realize that some of the things that you think are either normal or typical. I hate the word normal, but you know, typical or not.
Yeah.
And then conversely, also that some of the ways in which you are, you know, quirky and individualistic are actually part of a thing that lots of other people have. It was very weird to discover that my synesthesia, you know, that the way my brain works is a type and has a categorization and like a scientific, like it's been overwhelmingly positive and wonderful. And it's funny because there's this ongoing discussion and I'm in an online synesthesia group. I didn't join until recently because I didn't want to join while I was working on the book. I didn't want to borrow anyone else's story. I really wanted to make sure it was all coming from me. So, I mean, I did research, but like, I didn't want to accidentally borrow anyone else's story. So I joined once the book was finished. And there's this ongoing discussion of, is synesthesia a disability? And it's so subjective. Like, is anything a disability? I think that it should always be left into the eye of the beholder, or the, not the eye of the beholder, but the person who's experiencing it. We need more expansive language for what a disability is, because I think with many things that give us extra ability, everything gives and takes, the way our senses compensate, the way that, you know, somebody like, there are all of these like incredible athletes who are, you know, competing without a limb or without, you know, with all sorts of various, like what we'd call disabilities that they've turned into superpowers. Like the whole concept of disability is inherently fraught, and every individual should get the opportunity to decide how they want to talk about the way in which they're different. But I do think there's a world in which we all need to acknowledge that every single person is different in some way. You know, we have this umbrella term neurodiversity, which literally means brain difference. Like, aren't we all neurodiverse because our brains are all different? It's been a mind expanding experience to sort of step into this idea of being neurodiverse.
And that's why I love your book. And I highly recommend it, not only for teenagers, but also for parents of teenagers. And for me, it's like, boom, you know, we're all different. We're all special. We have these gifts of being different. And
just all about how do we use it to find meaning in life. There's meaning everywhere.
To find meaning and to reach out to others, I think.
Yeah, to connect.
And you've certainly done that in this interview today.
Thank you. So, it was really fun.
Yes. So thanks. A huge toda to Emily Barth Eisler for waking up early in Burbank. And
yeah, it's not that early. My kids are in school.
Yeah, for being on the program. And I'm Mel Rosenberg, the host of the Children's Literature Network, the Children's Literature Channel. I have to go back to school, Emily. The Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And I've been here with Emily Barth Eisler. And we're celebrating her new splendid book, The Color of Sound.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
I'm going to have you again. We just need a good excuse.
I'm available.
Okay. So go out and come back in. We've said goodbye to everybody else, and we'll just have a little sum up.
Okay, great.
Bye, everybody else.